I'm Roy D. Comstock.
And how do you spell your last name?
Comstock.
And Roy is spelled R-O-Y?
R-O-Y.
And it's that
baby.
November
3rd, 1922. In Cove.
And Cove, were you born at home?
Home.
Was it common for people to be born at home?
So there were six of us kids in the family, and well, five of them was born in that house, and one of them was born in South Dakota, my older sister, before they moved here.
When did your parents
move
here?
In May. They came from South Dakota in 1911.
And why did they move here from South Dakota?
They heard Oregon was a great place, and South Dakota wasn't the greatest place in the world to farm. And I was just a baby when they moved here.
And what year did you know when they moved here?
1911.
Thank you.
There was my uncle, or my great uncle Ansel, was here first, and he used to live up on where Charlie Short lives now. That was the Uncle Ansel place. It was known as Ansel Comstock. And he was the first one here. And then my dad and my grandfather moved here at the same time. Dad bought that ranch or farm. He was always a farmer. And he bought that, I don't know whether he bought that in 11 or 12, but he bought that right after he moved here.
I think it would be interesting.
He punched cows in South Dakota when he was a young man for my great uncle.
And then when you moved here, you bought a farm?
My ranch, yeah.
A ranch?
Right up, it's where, right up a mile from here.
What was it called?
Just the Comstock Place.
Okay.
It's where Moores live now. And, I think the road up there is named Comstock Road. The house has been remodeled two or three times, but Moores live in it now.
Did your father build the house there?
No. Added on to it, but not. There was a house there. My father put running water in the house, the first thing he did, and got electricity from the old Eastern Oregon Light and Power Company. He got the light poles out, and they put them in, and Dad owned the line from the Mill Creek Lane or road into his house for years. We had to keep it up as far as poles.
And you had to make sure they were standing.
Get new poles, new tamarack poles, whenever they say they need one. And then they took it over. I don't know what year they took it. They took it over from them. But for years we owned that line.
The other line, you had to maintain the poles that held it up.
That's right.
Did he actually put
it in himself? No, he dug the holes, but they put them in the ground for him. The fire company did.
So now you said you
had
two sisters?
No. Well, there were six of us in the family, three boys and three girls.
Mm-hmm. And which one were you?
I was the youngest.
Baby.
I'm the baby and the only one living now.
What do you remember about your early childhood?
Well, it was a happy childhood, I guess you'd say. We was, All of us worked on the farm, and always milked cows, and always had a large garden of berries, and made wooden posts Dad did to sell. In those days it was a lot different living than it is nowadays.
How so?
Well, money was hard to come by. Especially when the Depression hit, and I remember that when I was 8 or 9, there was just no money. lived it in, I guess, 1928 or 9, and for several years, there was just no money to be had. We always had plenty to eat because we raised our food. We had cows and chicken. Dad always had a lot of chickens, sold eggs, and everybody had cows and sold cream. And there used to be, I was thinking about that the other day, there were three cream routes that come in from Cove in those days. The co-op was in Union, and then Blue Mountain Creamery had a creamery over in the Grand and made butter, and made butter in Union, the co-op, and then there was an independent that came in and they shipped it down to Portland. But everybody had a place, had a cow or two or three or up to a dozen or two dozen cows.
So how do you remember the depression affecting your neighbors or the community as a whole? Everybody has a particular place that they miss.
Well, because we didn't. In those days, we didn't go, maybe we'd go to Le Grand once a week, or Dad would, to buy groceries and take the eggs in. Sold the eggs in Le Grand, and we'd get groceries, but petalberries, because we didn't have the money, and we didn't need the money that they do now. This wasn't the thing that, wasn't such thing as going to Le Grand to see a show or that, and we did have a show house at Cove at one time.
Really?
Yes.
Where was it?
Right down where, down just right near where the tavern is now.
Okay, and what was it called?
I have no idea.
Don't remember?
No, but there was a lot of things in Cove in the early days. But that they had how many sawmills? They had sawmill, of course that was in later years, but they had most obvious a sawmill in Cove.
What kind of a sawmill was it? What did it produce?
No, just lumber, and they sold it to farmers and different people. The one they used to call the Burkine Mill, and it was up on the way to the Moss Springs, and it closed down. And then they had the Wade Mill, sawmill, and then in later years, Clark Sharp and I forget what that man's name was. They built one at the end of Comstock Road there, right below Clifford Tolls, and right along Mill Creek there. And that burned down, and then they rebuilt that. And John Edwards built had an operating mill there, and it burned down. And then they had one pushed out in Cove.
What was that one called?
I'll think about it. It set right where the gymnasium sits now.
Oh, okay, on the school gymnasium.
Right there. There was one, and then there was one down below town on the Burke Hill place. I think the building is still there, or maybe they tore it down. But there was a sawmill there. That was the one they moved from there by the schoolhouse down. Down that building down there.
Okay, so the one that was where the school gymnasium, the high school,
and
they moved down.
They remodeled it and put a new one in, and then they tore it down, and the school bought that little log pond, bought that piece of property. Kennison Kennison was one of the owners. Ruth? No, Ruth. Well, I'll think of it yet.
Okay. Now you said that there used to be lots of things in Cove, like the show house and the mill.
The show house, I don't know what happened to the show house, but I guess when they got begin to get shows on the ground and maybe travel a little more, it didn't
pay
for itself. It used to be a banking code.
Really?
And of course the flour mill was operating. I remember when the flour mill operated.
What was it called?
Flour mill.
Called flour mill?
I don't know what the flour mill was called. It, and it's a part of the building is still over there.
Where was that?
That's, go to the post office and go south there, and it's where they have, I think they're making, I believe stoves in there, like camp stoves or something in there.
Okay.
And, of course, they had, the saloon, they used to have a saloon came in after Prohibition. Well, I guess they had a saloon in the early days, then Prohibition came, and then they, when I was in the sixth grade, they built a new schoolhouse down here. And we went to school in what was then the bank building. They moved the kids all over the Cove to go to school, and the fifth and sixth grade went in the bank building, and that was right on the corner where the tavern is now. And I remember then they sold had the first beer garden after Prohibition, and it was right where the post office is, right across the street from us. And Furhelms opened that up. And one time that building there was a drugstore there, and of course they always long many years they had a meat market in Cove. Lynn Chadwick had a meat market there, right where the hair salon is now. That was in, just above the post office building, right in there. And of course, they had two grocery stores, Bill Hallmark's Red and White is where the firehouse sat, and then in the building across the street was, when I was a kid, the Gardeners had a grocery store there.
Were they both open?
Both open, yeah, both
did
open.
Did they have similar items, or were they different?
No, they both were grocery stores, sold
the same
thing. And then, that was when I was in high school, in grade school and high school, and then they had, of course, always had a pool hall in Cove.
Really?
Someplace there. Oh, yes, that was, the pool hall was right above, there was another building right in there where the firehouse is. And that was a pool hall for years and years and years, and then it fell down, closed it down or something, and Bill Hallmark's grocery store went out of business, and he closed it up, and they opened pool hall there, and it operated for many years, right out on the corner where right on the corner right there where the fire, above the firehouse, on the corner there.
Let's go back to, you were talking about grades. What do you remember about school?
What do I remember about school?
Yeah, what do you remember about school? When did you start school?
When did I start?
Yeah.
Well, I guess for the first grade down here, when I was six, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And my first grade teacher was Thelma Anderson. She was her dad was a postmaster at the time, Logan Anderson. He was a postmaster, and Thelma Anderson was my first and second grade teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And Eva Duncan, which many kids went to her. She was the third and fourth grade teacher.
And, you
had combined
grades? What?
Two grades together, all through, they was always together until I graduated. Even after the new schoolhouse was built, while they was together. And the fifth and sixth grade teacher, I had Stella Edvilson from Union. And then the seventh and eighth grade teacher, and I think the last class she taught was Mrs. Mills. She was an excellent teacher and taught many years ago. And Jimmy Mills, and they had a, he was, our folks was quite close to them. They had a farm, just a half a mile above the schoolhouse, straight up the hill. It's where Bob Moxley lives now. But yeah, that's where they live. But I was in I went to school, and my first year in the new schoolhouse was the seventh grade.
So what was it like being in the new schoolhouse?
Oh, it was, of course, we had two grades together. It was, I mean, it was brand new. We thought it was great.
Did it seem to affect how you conducted yourself in your new building?
How we what?
How you conducted yourself.
No, everybody, I mean, I don't think that that made any change. As far as that goes, we we played out on the playground, and just like they do now, we most of them played softball or so, some game in the wintertime. We even put the fox and geese and all that business at the circle, but that's some of the games that they used to play.
What's fox and geese?
Well, you had you chomp a big circle with snow, and then different things coming into the center, and somebody's a fox and the rest are geese, and I mean, that was...
Is it sort
of
like tag?
Tag, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, in the snow, you'd have, it'd be a big circle and out on the playground, and they all just played that. But anyhow,
what's it like having two grades together? Did some of the older students help the younger students?
No, the teachers was, I mean, that was just the way it was. When one side was reciting or something, the other side, she would give lessons to from the, maybe you was doing your math or you was doing your reading or studying your spelling or something, while the other side was, the other class was doing something. That was common practice of all the schools there. Kind of like the one room schoolhouse, all 8 grades, but I never went to one of those, but they did have them. Yeah. Out in the valley. In fact, the Shanghai School was one of them that came into Cove, Frosty School, Lower Cove School.
Why is it called Shanghai?
I don't, but it's still, that building is still there.
Yeah, I see it when you
I don't know why it was Shanghai High School. But I think some of the people around Vietta had went to school in the Shanghai High School. John Van Schoonhover, I think he told me he did go to school in the Shanghai High School. But I always went here. In the old buses, the kids either walked to school, or the dad would take us sometimes in the wintertime. We'd even ride on a sleigh with a team.
Wow.
And some of us rode horses. I rode in high school. I rode a horse at times in the wintertime and tied it up. Had a barn there where one the corner there. Don't even know who lives there. But right across from where Carol Richardson lives now, that was a red barn that Al Puckett owned, and he let me keep my horse in the barn there, and it was nice that way. Just we were friends of him, in the wintertime, and people can't even imagine what it was, but on a weekend, and most weekdays, there would be from 10 to 30 teams go up in the mountains to get wood every day up this road.
Wow.
And,
every day, in the wintertime.
When they had snow with sleds. Of course, Saturdays and Sundays, that was a great time for the kids in Cove. They'd had their hand sleds and hook a ride behind one of those teams going up, or whoever wanted, and you go as far as you wanted to go up, and then you could coast all the way down. And it got icy because it was good. Many times on the hill, you'd have 30, 40 kids on a weekend sleigh riding, or sometimes we'd get together at night, a bunch after we got older, and have a sleigh riding party.
Yeah. Wow. Now, what roads
were
they
tied
down?
Well, the one going up, we used to call it the dump yard, but the one going up to Barrel Springs Way.
Okay.
But the red, where the red barn is on the corner there, that from there on up, that and we even went up the other way. Both roads was used. They hauled wood on both roads. Wood and,
how do you spell
it?
Barrel Way?
Huh?
Barrel Lane?
Oh, I don't know what the... Well, Barrel Springs.
Barrel or Barrel?
Barrel Springs.
Barrel
Springs.
A-R-R-E-L?
Yeah. The old timers know what Barrel Springs... In fact, they had a barrel where there's a spring up there.
Okay.
And that's the reason Barrel Springs and the other is Moss Springs Road. Both of them was used, but probably more wood is hauled because of... I don't know what year that burn was, but this country all burned, and that was what they called a big burn, and they would get wood out of that big burn for years and years.
Really? Now, was it a
forest fire?
Okay.
Started off south of here. My dad helped fight it on it, and it was started off towards Union Way and came through this whole country.
Wow.
And. It used to be you could see all the dead trees, but now a lot of people don't even know what we're talking about when we talk about the big burn, but that's what they used to call it.
So it started here in Union, it went
off
through.
South of Union, up High Valley Way, someplace but way up in there, and came clear through.
All the way through here, you go to reach what? It went all the way through to here in Coe.
No, up above Cole. I mean, it never got around Barrel Springs up in there, and even up the summit, up Moss Springs Way, it was in that Mill Creek, South Mill Creek Canyon there. Why it burned in there?
Yeah.
But the scars from that is pretty well all grown in. But any of the old timers would know what I'd be talking about. Young ones, they can't imagine seeing those trees there for years.
Amazing how they grow back.
But in that same area, we had a, when I was in high school then, we had a 4-H club, and it was a forestry club, and we went up, and Alvin Orton and somebody, he was a mail carrier here for years, mm-hmm. and he was the leader, and we went up and planted some trees up in there.
Is that what
you
did with the forest group?
What?
Is that what the forestry
group? It was a forestry club, yeah, and I don't know whether there's anybody else that I can't think of anybody else that was in that right now with alive, but there may be some. I don't know.
What other things did the forestry club do?
Well, We had meetings. We had campouts. We went in fishing one time. I don't remember. They took us in on Little Mine fishing, and we camped out.
And now, when did the forest fire happen? Do you
I don't. That was.
What
I don't. It was before I can even remember. I think it was and. Don't hold me to this, but I think it was around 1919, but I don't know for sure. Oh yes, before I was born.
Okay.
But the trees, I mean, the old black pine trees are still good for years after that, standing there. They stood there, and a lot of those dead tamaracks that was hit that fire stood there, and they hauled thousands of cords of wood out of there. I mean, literally did over the years mm-hmm. from that fire. That wood, you talk about the wood, I said my dad made wood, every winter we'd make wood up on that place because we had timber and the year I graduated from high school, which was, it had been 1941, Dad had, and it was cordwood. And you probably don't know what cordwood is, but
I don't.
It's 4-foot 4 foot long, and it, then you'd use a buzzsaw and make it into 16-inch wood.
Okay.
And Dad had over 100 cord of that made in the wintertime, and I think he paid $1 a cord to have it made. And before I left here in 41, in the fall, Dad and I got that out of it before I left. And a lot of that wood was sold for $3.50 to $5 a cord delivered. Now it's $100 some. And this was green cut wood, sawed up in 16 inch and delivered in hand cold.
Wow.
That's how the money is different.
Mm-hmm. So you said you left in 41. Did you go into the service area?
No, I, because everybody in at that time knew war was coming, and I saw this ad in the paper about working in the aircraft deal, and I wrote a letter, I think, and got reply to went to school in L.A. I was an 18-year-old kid, got on the train and went to L.A., didn't know a soul, and the people at the school met me, and I lived in a rooming house where I can't even think how much it was. The school wasn't very much. Dad and mother was quite skeptical about the whole thing, but it turned out all right. I mean, in that rooming house, I got to where I was a friend of a... I asked for a job for my board and room when, after I was there a few days, and I met this manager, and I washed dishes for a while. Every morning, I washed dishes before I'd go to school. And this happened, week 10 days, one day he came by and he said, in the morning, he said, I got my breakfast out of it too that way. Got my meals, as I remember, to wash the dishes. And he said, tomorrow morning, you come and eat breakfast with me. I said, well, I won't have my dishes done. He said, don't worry about dishes, you're not doing them anymore. And so I went and ate breakfast with him, and from then on, I went around and then it kind of just followed him around and inspected. He took a liking to me, and I didn't have to wash dishes, and I got my board in the room, and everything was fine.
Wow. Now, what did you learn in school?
Well, it was just enough to get a job, but I got a job at Consolidated Aircraft in San Diego. I'm making B-24 bombers. And I worked there, I don't know when I went to work there, but I worked there and lived in San Diego till January of 42, and my older brother passed away, and I came home and I never went back. I was supposed to go back, but I didn't. And
what kept you here?
Well, I didn't stay here. I went over to Pendleton and went to welding school, a crash course in welding, and went down to Portland and worked in the shipyard making the Liberty ships, Swan Island, to Kaiser. And in July of 42, I enlisted in the, as a naval cadet, V5 program. And I stayed there until I was called, I think it was in September, and I started here in LeGrand. Flying, and we lived in the old Foley, house right across from Montgomery Ward. They took that over, the government did, and it's what they called a CPT program, civilian pilot training. And I got my primary, got my license there, just flying Cubs. And then we went from there, and we took classes up to college too, ground school classes. Huh?
At Eastern?
Yes.
Now, you said that they had a training place in LeGrand, was it? Or Union?
No, LeGrand.
LeGrand. And so there was other people around here?
Oh, yes. They came from all over.
Okay.
Some of them from Portland, all over in that program. There were some in the Army and some in the Navy. And the funny part of the thing is the Navy people, we got 75. I believe it was $75 a month, and the Army wasn't getting anything, and they was quite thin. But later on, they did get the brought a lot more Army in, and they eliminated the Navy program, I think. But from there, I went to Prineville in secondary.
For the Army didn't get anything? Was that?
Well, I don't think they did. Just for pay. They didn't have to pay anything, but they might have got something, but I don't think they got as much as we did.
You got $75.
As I remember, we got, yeah.
And you were being trained.
Huh?
And while you were being trained.
Uh-huh.
And then did you live at home while you
were trained? Oh, no, we lived in that Foley building.
Okay.
And then there was a cook there. I can't even think of her name now. But I'll probably get ahead of the story on some of the stuff you wanted. I don't know.
That's okay. We can just backtrack a little bit at a time. And then you were sent to Prineville?
Well, we went to Madras. And this is for secondary. We were flying Stearman's then. And, anyhow, at Madras, the living conditions where we were staying, it's in the Madras Hotel. And we was downstairs and a bunch of us and the sewer conditions was like terrible, so they moved us, they closed it down, where they condemned it there, it just got so bad that we moved to Prineville, and I was still in secondary, hadn't finished the thing when I was called down to Navy pre-flight school at St. Mary's, California, so I went from Prineville to St. Mary's then. I was in the Navy then because it was an E-5 program, Naval Aviator.
Now, what happened with, did you meet Ruth while you were growing up here in Cove?
Oh, no, that was many years afterwards.
Okay. Where did you meet Ruth?
Down in Pensacola, Florida.
Okay, so you haven't gotten in yet. Okay, so you're in the V5 program, and they sent you back down to California.
St. Mary's pre-flight school.
Pre-flight school.
St. Mary's College, and went through that, and then I went into. After we finished that, I went to primary Navy primary training, which was flying the old Yellow Perils, the N3Ns. We went to Los Alamitos. In California, for in primary base, and then during that time, why they closed that and made that an operational base for the Navy planes, and I was transferred to Dallas, Texas. We went from the cool sea breeze to 105 degrees, and almost overnight, as long as the train ride took us, and it was terrible. It was hot in the summertime, but I finished primary at Dallas. And then we went to some of them went to Corpus Christi, but I was fortunate to went to Pensacola. Annapolis of the Air, that was known as, still is, I guess. Mm-hmm. And went through all of schools there. And met Ruth on a blind date before I got commissioned. And, in fact, she pinned the wings on me when I got commissioned and got my wings.
Wow!
Yeah,
how did that happen?
Well,
they pinned you the wings and you could put them on me?
No, I'm saved.
Okay.
And, of course, they had ceremonies for the...
Down right outside.
They had a ceremony for all the graduating... and commissioned officers and graduating there, and then from there, I went to Jacksonville, Florida, flying SBD's dive bomb plane, and we finished that, and they shipped us out to California, El Toro. Marine base. I went in the Marine Corps when I commissioned. I kind of got ahead of myself. But some of us could go in the Marine Corps. We'd put in for it, and they'd take so many. And that's the reason I went into the Marine Corps. It's still a naval service, but I was in the Marine Corps part. Some of the ones I went to school with was would be Navy ensigns, and I was a second lieutenant.
So you started out in the Navy.
Started out in the Navy.
Then you went into the Air Force.
No, I went in, not the Air Force.
Okay.
Marine Corps.
Then you went to the Marine Corps.
When I got commissioned.
It was through the Navy that you went through flight school, and then you were commissioned to the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then that's when I finished flight school.
Okay.
And then, I was a second lieutenant at Jacksonville Port, Cecil Field there. And then I went to El Toro, and we practiced dive bombing there until we got our orders to go overseas.
Now, when did you find the time to marry Duke?
After I'd been overseas and flew my term and time and come back on leave.
Okay. How long were you over there flying? Whereabouts?
Well, I was in a little island of Emeru. In the Southwest Pacific for a while, and then in the invasion of the Philippines, where we ferried our planes up, flew them up. It took, I think, 6 days to fly them up. We flew behind a DC-3, and they had a flying boat to pick up any stragglers or anybody that had to go down. And I was on the invasion of Blue Zone at Lingayen Gulf, and then we flew down to invasion of Mindanao at Zamboanga. So I was on both invasions there.
Yeah. How long were you away doing
that? How many? 14?
Wow. You counted?
Flew 85 missions.
Wow. Now, during this time, did you have the chance to correspond with your family?
Oh, we wrote letters.
Yeah. What was their impression? Did they see your initial move to L.A.?
To start with, when I...
Right.
Well, no, but we, of course, then we weren't in war until, December 7th. In fact, San Diego, I was watching a football game, a pro football game in Balboa Stadium, when at halftime the game, it was the San Diego Bombers again, L.A. I don't think it's Rams then, but halftime, a lot of the San Diego players never came back out, and nobody could figure out why. And about that time, those newspapers hit the stands that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. And, of course, I didn't know what Pearl Harbor was. What was Pearl Harbor, But all the Marine personnel was immediately called back to the base there. And that's why they didn't come out.
Oh, okay. So, you said that your parents were initially skeptical of going down there to begin with.
You mean when I first went down?
Yeah.
Well, there wasn't any... There were local jobs here, farm jobs, in 1941. There wasn't any industry I just knew I wanted to do something. I didn't have money really for college, and that was the way I thought I could get ahead.
We could
only say so much because it was supposed to be censored. Everything was, in fact, every picture you sent home was censored. Stamp a lot of course the officers. We could have said more than we did in it, but we weren't supposed to say where we were and what we were doing. And they knew he was on bombing machines, and they knew I was a pilot, they knew I was on strikes, but they didn't know. Because the news coverage was not like it is now. You didn't have television, you had radio, but they didn't like it. They didn't probably know I was on the invasion of the Philippines until they began to get letters from up there. And most, I can show you how it's, what some of the sensors things are, but it doesn't say where you were.
Mm-hmm.
It just past sensor.
So did you care about what local
news was? Oh yeah, they'd send me clippings of, you know, but by then I was away from here for 2 years, and of course, all the people I knew was in the service practice at that time. I mean, it was all out war.
Did they tell you much about how effective the communities were to have young men leave?
Well, I knew, and when I come home on leave before I went overseas, of course, you had sugar rationing, you had meat points, meat rationing, and you had gasoline rationing.
Tires.
You had tires rationing. On the farm, you'd get a little more, and of course, most of the meat and that on the farm, you didn't worry about, or you even had butter that was rationed. Dad had the gasoline. When I come home on leave, I used to get how many gallon nuts? You went in and you'd apply for, and they'd give servicemen so many gallon of gas. It didn't like now. I mean, maybe, I don't know, I'm just saying, I can't remember whether they got 8 or 10 or 15 gallon of gas, but it wasn't much.
Mm-hmm.
But the only place we'd probably, the only place we'd go would be La Grande.
Right.
What now?
Because they had their own
food
and whatnot?
Well, that part, living on the farm, but they had their own meat. We always had meat and eggs and all the vegetables and fruit. So the only thing you had to buy really was staples and that kind of sugar and flour Well, flour, I don't think flour was rationed, but sugar was rationed.
Yeah.
But even when I was, I'll go back a ways, when I was a kid, I remember we always had a big berry patch. And I don't know whether you know how much strawberries cost now, a box or a crate.
An individual pint-sized basket can be at least a dollar, or probably more like,
then we'd raise strawberries, and there's crates, what we call crates. There are 24 cups to a crate.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is cups, same size.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember lots of times they would sell for $1.50 to $2 a crate.
Wow.
Now this, I'm talking about a crate.
Right, not the little pint.
Not the little pint. Then they got to where they were selling flats. And one time, we had wonderful strawberries, and the local, back then, the store, the corner, Dollar's Corner, George Anderson put that in there, and he found out we had strawberries, and I think we got $3 a flat, and that was wonderful money in those days then. That was for 12 cups. Well, it was later. Yeah. It was years afterwards.
Wow, really?
I mean, like.
Well, like 20 years.
Like 20 years afterwards. Yeah. But it was, in the early days, it was kind of a race to see who'd get their berries picked and get into La Grande and ahead of the other ones to get to the stores, because they could only pick so much.
Right. Did you and your siblings help pick the strawberries?
Oh, yes. And raspberries and black caps, blackberries. We always had two berry patches, cane berries and strawberries. And it was a
cane berries being like raspberries?
Raspberry, black caps, and blackberries. Yeah.
Caps and blackberries.
Well, black cap is a black raspberry, and a black It's just like a black, as a raspberry is black.
Okay.
And a blackberry is bigger.
Blackberry.
Is a blackberry.
I knew what blackberry was and a raspberry, but I don't think I've ever had a black cat.
Well, it's just like a they're around, but getting back to picking berries, this is before, of course, I was in high school. There was a local lady, and she wanted some huckleberries, and I went up and picked huckleberries, and I'd ride my horse up, and I'd get 3 gallons of huckleberries, and I got $1 a gallon for them.
Wow, you rode up here up the mountain range?
Mm-hmm. We ride from home up there. I think they sell $20 a gallon. At least, yeah. But that, I thought that was wonderful money. Because my first working out, I got $1 a day.
Wow.
Haying.
Oh, haying.
Haying, $1 a day.
That's completely different.
$1 a day. So.
Right.
And then they begin to... I can remember when they started getting 25 cents an hour for farm labor. And of course, that 10 hours a day, you get 2.5.
Right. When did they start changing the payment per day for work versus per hour?
About that time.
When you were in high school?
Well, and later. And some of them still paid by the day, you know. But it, of course, now it's all hourly, but it was a...
But
it was $1 a day. I mean, a lot of times, that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. So you did haying. About what age did you start doing that sort of thing?
It was whenever you were big enough to...
When were you big enough to do that?
Well, of course, we worked on the farm until you were big enough to go out and that some other farmer would think you were big enough to handle a pitchfork or whatever you was doing. And I suppose 12 to 14, in high school age, begin to. Everybody that milked cows almost in Cove had a silo. Raid corn had a silo. And when I was in my senior year, the year I went left here, I think I still helped, and we traded, you know.
Labor for labor.
And I would go for him, and I think I filled 12 or 14 silos that year, different ones around. And I don't know if any of those silos are still standing. I don't know, but every place had a silo.
And was it all used for corn, all the silos?
The corn was raised for the silos.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you just got everything, didn't you? You picked berries?
Oh, yeah. I mean, whatever you could make it. We didn't get what you call allowance. We got what we wanted, you know, but we didn't have money to spend much. It just wasn't there for a long time. But
so did other kids besides yourself when you were a child go out and get work so you had money to spend?
Another thing that and I don't think there's anybody does it now, maybe one or two in the whole Union County, but every kid had a trap line for fur in the fall and winter.
Really, what kind of
fur
did they
catch? Muskrat and mink.
Wow.
Every kid had his own territory. You just didn't go stomping in on somebody else's place.
What would happen if you did?
Well, it'd be a fight.
That's what I
wanted. I had this milk creek up in here, and you'd. You'd get from anywhere from as low as 50 cents up to, I think I got up to maybe $3 or $4 at the best on the muskrat. Mink was, of course, if you're lucky enough to catch the mink, well, they was higher priced.
Yeah.
I think they would go up around $20,
yeah.
Which was, I mean, but
a lot more money then than it is now.
Yes, yeah.
Now, when did kids stop doing that? Do you remember?
When money got, I don't know when they stopped trapping. I don't.
But from your memory, from your childhood through when you left the area in high school, kids are still trapping.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Well, zoom back to you working being overseas in the Marine Corps, and then you came back, leave, and you married Ruth. Did you do that in Texas?
No, we did that here in the Grand.
Oh, so where did you meet her? You met her on a blind date, where?
In Pensacola.
So you're from Pensacola. And then you came here a month before you came home. Come on up.
No, I don't think this is Colin. She was here when I got here. It was just letters. But anyhow, that's... I imagine. No, I don't think it's 6 months because I wasn't there that long.
She came here and left with your family, and so you came home?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it was about 10 days, I guess, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I guess something like that. When I come home, the war was still going on. In
right.
fact, we had our orders. When we left here after we married, we went back to Cherry Point, and we was forming an SB-2C squadron for the invasion of Japan. If they hadn't dropped the big one, why, we would have been on the invasion of Japan with SB-2Cs, but that's another dive bomber. But SBD is a dive bomber. In fact, there it is right up on the wall.
Mm-hmm. Then once the war was over, what brought you back here to the
United States? Well, it was home, I guess. Yeah. And I got tried airlines, and there was a 100,000 pilots for 1,000 jobs. You know how that was.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't get on airlines, and so then I got my instructor's license and worked over at the airport here for about a year, I guess, about.
What year did you move back to Pensacola?
Well, yeah, we bought this place in 1949. 49. Dave was born here. Spring of 49. It didn't have inside plumbing. I mean, it didn't have a toilet in the house when we bought it. So I did put the bathroom in that house when we moved there. That first thing we did. Huh? Well, I know, but we were farming, but anyhow.
You taught for a year here in local airport.
Huh?
You taught
over here at the airport.
Right, for about a year.
Uh huh. And then we went back to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Went to Spartan School of Aeronautics, and I got my instrument rating. I already had my instructor's rating, and aircraft and engine license. And we went to. Moved to Iowa, and I worked there for over a year, I guess. Sure. Yeah, our oldest son was born there, and the rest of them were born here in the south, or not in the south, but here in the Grand.
Wow, so what brought you back again then?
Well, starving out, I mean, it was, but what making a fortune, what making big wages instructing, you got so much an hour, and you had to have a, you had to have a lot of students to make a real good living. I got $3 an hour for dual time and $1 for solo time, and that's what I got. But I most of the time I had a guarantee of about $200 a month, which that was in 48 and 49. Well, no, I'm talking about when I was instructing there.
So you said it wasn't making enough.
No.
And so when you moved back here again then in
49. Well, in the fall of 40, John was just a baby. Fall of 48, and then that next spring we bought that place, the place here.
How did you go from being an airplane flight instructor to a farmer? And what?
Well, I grew up as a farmer, and my dad had fruit, and this had fruit on it, and this place, and it was available, and we was able to, with what money we'd saved and loan, well, we was able to get it, struggle through.
So you had fruit already on here with
the
fruit trees?
It was fruit trees here. The old Carl Stacklin. The old Carl Stacklin place, yeah.
You had a bunch of fruit trees, pears, and what else?
Well, the pears we took, pears wasn't a marketable crop. The cherries is what was marketable. And we raised cows and hogs and berries and pull a ball of wax to make a, and milk cows, and then I'd work out in, I worked, besides that, I worked for Boise Cascade, and I'd done two jobs. It was a struggle, but
what did you do for Boise Cascade?
Well, I worked some at the sawmill, and then when the particle board opened, I got a job there, and I was there until I retired. I went to work there in 1966 and retired in 85. And I was an operator there.
And you said you raised milk cows?
Oh, yeah, we milk cows here, too, and
you
hogs.
Beef cows?
We had beef cows, and yeah.
And then you had some children. Were they your main helpers on the farm?
Oh yeah, they helped on the farm, and they were I don't know about now, but well, some of the kids work on work farm, high school kids. But as soon as they were able, they got a job for helping somebody on the farm if we didn't have a job for money. Money was still hard to come by.
Had a lot of work going on when you were working from
there.
Were you Cascade or other people
were working? Well, we hired the pickers. We always had pickers. Fruit tramps. Yeah, that's white. We called them fruit tramps. That's what they call themselves. Fruit
tramps.
Yeah, that was the name of them. I mean, anybody in those days, fruit tramp. They came in from every year. It isn't like nowadays when the Mexicans come in the crews. These would come in ones and twos and maybe a carload.
And they would sleep in tents and camp out?
They'd camp out.
So like the trees?
Huh? Camp under the trees. And right here in our own, well, in the house, there used to be a barn here. But there obviously it was two or three camps here and three or four camps up up in the orchard, up the water up there, the ditch there.
Were they Mexicans?
No, Mexicans. Then it's all white people, all white. I probably started some of the first Mexicans here in Cove, but they were just single carloads.
Right. What time frame
do you know did they start to change from being white? Near 1975 to 80 or 80, maybe 80, 82, in that area.
And you said you're one of the first to hire them?
Mm-hmm.
Were other farmers skeptical of hiring them?
Well, it wasn't so much the other farmers, but the white pickers didn't want
them.
It was hard to get them in. Some of the white pickers wouldn't work with them. I had good pickers. Everybody had good pickers, and we had bad pickers. And some of them used to be some of our best friends and come back for years and years. In fact, their kids would come back and pick for us. We had two families that was that way.
If you decided to go ahead and hire some Mexican
pickers? Well, they didn't have enough pickers. We got sort of white pickers went. Well, it was good, but they just don't have any coming in. Well, I don't know whether you want to go back in the war years. I got a Distinguished Flying Cross with Custer and Air Medal with Custer's.
Yeah, sure.
Distinguished Flying Cross. Yes, and the Air Medal with Custer.
And then back to your farm, and that you retired from Boise Cascade. Did you still have your farm going at that time?
We'd sold some of it, and.